The dulcet tones of Christopher Cross lead us into our Tuesday first hour segments today of SalesportTalk.com, as we are making an effort to get our guest today. But my co-host, Karen Lyle, who is also sheltering in place in the East Bay, as am I, has joined us. How are you, Karen?
I'm doing great. You know, I'm looking out over a bit of fog, and you know, it reminds me of London somehow. You know, I think that we're in tune with that Portsmouth and London today.
Well, I can tell you that it was pretty darn freezing around these parts yesterday. So yes, it did feel just a tad like jolly old London. Have you been out on the San Francisco or San Pablo Bays lately?
Yes, I have. I've been making it a point to go out every week, and you know, but I like to go when the sun is out. You know, it's just one of those things. So I'm not sure if it's going to be today, but it should be. We'll get a little sun peeking out, and I'll be out there on the water for sure.
All right. Well, joining us not once, not twice, but thrice, we're thrilled to have Sir Robin Knox-Johnston, CBE, who was the first person to perform a single-handed, nonstop circumnavigation of the globe. And, of course, then did it at the age of 67, was the oldest yachtsman to do the solo race as well. Sir Robin, welcome to the show. I'm tempted to say the good Sir Robin, but that would be Eric Idle in the Holy Grail, wouldn't it?
So you've watched that.
You know, many, many times. So I did want to ask you one question just to start off as an aside. You were a baby at the time, but do you remember the Blitz in London, or stories of the Blitz and how you had to scramble about?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was born just before the war, and so I remember staying with an aunt in London and a V1 coming over, and my mother saying, oh, that's all right, the engine stopped, and the aunt saying, get them up and wrap them in eiderdowns, that's coming down. It actually is a cinnamon and killed 600 people, apparently. Yeah, no, I do remember it. I remember watching the contrails of the aircraft, you know, when I was about 3 or 4, up above. And then at night, you hear the sound of about 1,000 British bombers taking off to go and give it back. So, yes, remember it well.
Wow.
Well, you know, Sir Robin, I've been thinking a lot lately about merchants. Seaman, and I know that you started out your career early as a merchant seaman. Can you tell us a little bit about that experience and what a merchant seaman is?
Yes. We when I went to sea, I mean, Britain had by far the largest merchant fleet in the world, about 150,000 people. And there was a very good training system. We did a 4-year apprenticeship at sea on a ship, learning our trade. At the end of those 4 years, we could take what was called a second mate certificate, and this meant you were a qualified navigator and a qualified watchkeeper. And then you joined a ship as third officer or third mate, and you slowly worked your way up. I spent a total of 14 years with a company called the British India Steam Navigation Company. We had about 180 ships. 80 ships. One time we had 180, but that was another time. But it was an interesting career in those days because you joined a ship, you probably stayed on it for a year, year and a half, maybe 2 years. You went to some interesting places. You had time in port. It was before containers. So you actually did get time in port while you loaded cargo. And I loved it. I thought it was, I enjoyed doing it. It was a great career. You saw the world, saw a lot of interesting places. But I think the main thing about it was the training they gave us. My company had two ships. They took the crew off and manned it with apprentices. So we had to do everything. We had to qualify as able seamen. We had to do everything, chipping paint, to cleaning the bilges, to learning to work out how to navigate with a sextant, because we didn't have AIS or even there were no satellites in those days. We had a very, very good training, and it was largely in the hands of people who'd been through the war. And they were actually quite tough on us because they said, look, there could always be another war. You've got to be ready for it. And so they really trained us hard, and I've always been very grateful for that.
Out here in the Bay Area, we have one of the two United States Maritime Academies to train up merchant marines. So for you, I know, you know, in Greenwich, there's a great history there. But at the Portsmouth dockyards, they've been training, you know, Royal Navy officers down there forever. Where did you get your training, Sir Robin?
Well, it was on the ships in those days. We actually did the training at sea. We joined the ship as a what was called a first tripper with no knowledge whatsoever. And you started off doing all the menial jobs, and you slowly put yourself up. But, I know. I mean, I've got an honorary doctorate from Maine Maritime Academy. So, you know, I know about your system, and I've actually spent some time with the U.S. Coast Guard on the Eagle when I was president of the Sail Training Association. We used to run the tall ships races. And I was very interested to see how you Americans train people. And the Eagle seemed the obvious place to go, and they very kindly invited me on board. And I spent a week on board seeing how you do it. It's different to us. It's a different system, but I think it's, nevertheless, I was impressed. I thought it's an effective system. But it was interesting to see another slant on how you train people to go to sea.
What did you notice were some of the differences?
I think the way on the Eagle, anyway, they were giving young people a lot of responsibility early on. Okay, it was supervised, but quite early on they were being told, right, you're navigating this ship. We'd have to build up to it more slowly. But on the Eagle, the young U.S. Coast Guard people there were being put right into it right from the start. And I actually quite like that. I think it develops a good understanding. It was a good system.
Yeah, I was thinking the main difference in our navies would be that we have lieutenants and you have lieutenants, and that your carriers on the flight decks are curved up at the end. And my father, who was in the Navy, the U.S. Navy, the first time I saw that was during the Falklands War. I think it was on the Invincible. And I thought, well, that looks stupid. And my dad said, that's actually really smart. I wish the U.S. had those curved flight decks.
Well, I think in some respects we'd wish we got cats and traps, which your father would understand. But it works very effectively with vertical takeoff aircraft like the Harrier and the F-35B because it gives them that extra lift up into the air at the last minute. It was invented by a naval officer, a lieutenant commander, in fact. I think they rewarded him with £10,000 for his invention. But it does work. And our two new carriers have both got it because, of course, they're going to fly the F-35B.
I remember asking a Harrier pilot, why didn't he always just do a vertical takeoff? And he said it would burn up half his fuel. And I said, okay, now yes. I understand why.
That's right. We were trying to give him a greater range and a greater payload. In fact, the Harrier was a remarkable aircraft. It could carry an awful lot. It was just subsonic. But it was an amazing aircraft, really. In the Falklands War, they used to VIF. If they had been pursued by Argentine fighters, they'd VIF, which means they suddenly stop going forward and they go vertical. And, of course, the Argentines would overshoot them, and, of course, then they're an easy target.
That's right, VIFF.
Oftentimes, as sailors, we're all about the boats. What's the relationship between the ships that you were on as a merchant seaman and the crew and the captain? Is there that same kind of bond that there is with a sailor in a boat?
I think you've got, we always had huge respect for our captains. I mean, we always realized he knows more than we do. And so when he said something, you know, you just did it. You didn't argue with him. I mean, sometimes they come up and chat to you, ask you about things. So I remember one particular captain said, have you ever done a Richardson turn? And I said, no. He said, well, let's do one. We had a bit of time to spare. It's a way of going back to find someone who's fallen overboard and very, very effective. I'd never done it practically. I don't think many people have, but this captain was one of those captains who encouraged you along. Great guy to sail with, delightful man. But, you know, it's a different system to, say, the military navies, because I've served in both. I was communications officer on a frigate for a while as a reservist, and it's a different system. You don't have the Articles of War, as we call it, in the Merchant Navy. It's much more upon character. You know, if you're the mate of a ship, the chief officer mate, you're running the crowd, the seamen. And they'll respect you because they know damn well you can do the job as well as they can. In the navies, they tend to take their officers and train them as we do at Dartmouth and you do at Annapolis. And they don't get to sea until they've been there a while. And I think, in a way, it would be better if they went back to sending them to sea to start with to learn some of the trades that they're going to have to instruct seamen to do or tell seamen to do. The seamen respect you more if they know you can do it.
Yes, there's no doubt that practical teaching is better than theoretical teaching. We're speaking with Sir Robin Knox Johnston. He's going to stay with us. We're going to have another segment with him, a Knight of the Realm. And Karen Lyle, of course, my co-host for these segments, will be along with us for another segment as well after a quick break. If you'd like to join, the toll-free line is 1-800-878-PLAY. That works over the entire continent, United States, Mexico, Canada. Come on in at 1-800-878-PLAY. If you're listening overseas on American Forces Radio Network, we'd love to hear you as well. I'm Rick Tittle. Come on back on Sports Byline.
This is Karen Lyle with the Salesport Talk Historical Spotlight. On July 16, 1881, Ida Lewis was awarded the rare Gold Life-Saving Medal, the first woman to receive it. The citation for the Gold Life-Saving Medal said, "Rescuing from drowning at various times at least 13 persons, and particularly for the rescue of two soldiers who had broken through the ice near Lime Rock on the afternoon of February 4, 1881. During her lifetime, Lewis was called the bravest woman in America, and her exploits were detailed in the national press. She met President Ulysses S. Grant. Members of the women's suffrage movement, including Elizabeth Cady Stanton, at least two pieces of music were named for her, the Ida Lewis Waltz and the Rescue Polka Mazurka. In 1924, the Rhode Island legislature officially changed the name of Lime Rock to Ida Lewis Rock. The Lighthouse Service changed the name of Lime Rock Lighthouse to the Ida Lewis Rock Lighthouse, the only such honor ever paid to a keeper in the United States. It is now the clubhouse of the Ida Lewis Yacht Club. The burgee of the Ida Lewis Yacht Club features a lighthouse with 18 stars representing the 18 people rescued by Ida Lewis. This is Karen Lyle of Sailsport Talk. The annual Ida Lewis distance race, scheduled for a start off of Newport, Rhode Island on Saturday, August 15th, is one of New England's premier sailing events. The presenting partner for 2020 is Genoa America. Gold partner is Sailsport Talk. Silver partners are Contender Sailcloth and Safe Harbor Newport Shipyard. Bronze partners are Gold's Wine and Spirits, Newport Construction Services, and Stella Artois. Contributing sponsors are Gosling's Rum, Mac Designs, Tony Mills Graphic Design, and Triton Insurance. Karen Lyle of Sailsport Talk with a shout-out to InShape Health Clubs in Capitola, El Dorado, and Kern County, California, all of which are open. InShape Health Clubs are not only a member of the iTex trading community, where your iTex dollars are welcome, they benefit the American Cancer Society and St. Jude Children's Hospital. Visit InShape.com for the latest on our open locations and online programs. That's InShape.com. This is Sailsport Talk, recognizing local businesses around the world that make each city unique.
Driving through the San Francisco Bay and Tri-City area, All Bay Collision is a one-stop shop including full detail wash and steam clean of engines, auto restoration, and auto body repair for cars, SUVs, buses, ambulances, box trucks, big rigs, fleet accounts, and fiberglass repair. Tow available. With over 60 years of experience, you are in good hands. Visit allbaycollision.com or call 510-489-1313 or 510-825-4727.
Sailing takes me away, away. All right, thank you for that. Welcome back to the show. Rick Tittle with you, coast to coast, around the world on American Forces, co-hosted with Karen Lyle here with SalesportTalk.com. And nice enough to join us for another segment, Sir Robin Knox Johnston, one of the most accomplished solo sailors of all time. Sir Robin, I wanted to ask you about, you mentioned a maneuver for going back to rescue someone who had gone overboard. Is that a straight move where you just try to come about as soon as possible? Do you go into a circular pattern? What was that maneuver you were talking about?
It's a very clever maneuver. You turn the helm hard to starboard, and you come around 80 degrees and then go hard to port. And you'll come back. You then steady up on a reciprocal course. And the time we tried it out, we were, I don't know, within about 3 yards of our original track. So wow. If someone had gone overside, very good chance we're going to find them. It's something that was being developed by seamen everywhere. I don't know who developed it, except for Richardson, I suppose. But it's a very, very effective method.
Yeah, with a sailboat, we often call those man overboard exercises. And, the maneuver is a little bit different. Not on a ship that size. What size, how long, what's the length overall on a ship like that?
Well, we were an 8,000-ton ship, the one I did it with. We're 450 feet, 500 feet. We're quite a big ship, but it worked. And it does work. I mean, say when we do it in yachts, we have a totally different system, because if you're in a sailing boat, the first thing you've got to do is get control of the boat, which means getting rid of the sails and getting the engine on and getting back. And, of course, while you're doing that, you can't start doing clever turns. This is why we always have someone on lookout. We always press the button to note where the person went overside. And then we go back. I lost a guy overside in the Whitbread race in the middle of the Southern Ocean. And by the time we got the spinnaker down and tried to get the engine started, and eventually it did, and then the propeller wouldn't open, but eventually it did, and we turned on the reciprocal course, we couldn't see him. But we knew where he was because the albatross was circling over him, no doubt thinking, here's breakfast. Anyway, we got him back after about 20 minutes. He was fine, apart from a cut in his hand, and still alive today.
I love that British bulldog mustn't grumble sort of attitude like that. An American would write a whole novel about that perilous 20 minutes. Anyway, wanted to ask you about the Clipper Around the World race that you started in the 90s. And I was just thinking about how hard it was when I organized the pub soccer team. How do you organize the logistics of doing a round the world yacht race? What were some of the headaches to get that going?
I think the biggest headaches normally come from the bureaucrats. If I want to run a race, I've got a tremendous team working with me, many of whom have been with me almost 20 years now. And these are the guys I rely upon. They know how I like things done. I don't have to supervise them. They keep me informed. I stand back and let them get on with it because, give people responsibility, they'll behave responsibly. But, I mean, my race director's been with me for over 10 years, highly experienced, skipper the boat around the world. He looks after the side of things. I've got other people looking after the port stops and making arrangements with the hosts in the ports. I've got other people obviously looking after PR because that's essential. Other people looking after the crews, making sure they're being taken care of. And we also employ someone just to look after the crew's families so that they're kept informed. There's nothing worse than for people who don't know anything about sailing, and 40% of our crews have never been on a boat when we get them. That's before we give them a quite intensive four-week training.
We have a
Their families want to know if they're all right, what's going on, what's the news from the boats. So it's important we get messages back from the boats daily, tell people what's going on, enable them to make contact if they have to. All these things that come into it, and so you need a team that's capable of taking charge of all that and running it as effectively as any commercial organization, to be honest.
Right. We have a phone call. We have Patty, who's right here in San Francisco. Patty, you're on with Rick, Karen, and Sir Robin.
Hello, Sir Robin. It's Patty Mann.
Hello.
I met you when you came into South Beach Yacht Club during the Clipper race back in, I think, maybe 2014 or so. And yep. That was the race that that was the race where the gentleman, the crew member, went overboard in the middle of the night, in the middle of the race, and was found, I think you would know the details better than I, maybe 20 to 40 minutes later?
Longer.
And, longer than that, really. And
yeah, it was 1 hour, 40 minutes. He went overside. His life jacket, which has got automatic inflation, didn't work. He had an AIS beacon in his life jacket. He switched it on, but he switched it to test, not on. Mm-hmm. We've since replaced those because it's confusing. Mm-hmm. The result was the boat immediately went back and started a search, and it was using a well-used search pattern. And they were sitting there hoping to pick up his beacon, but of course it didn't do. He realized when the boat came close to him after about 50 minutes, and then turned away from him, that something was wrong. At that point, he checked his beacon and realized he put it onto test. So when the boat came back next time, they picked him up. They got a reading from his beacon, and then they went and picked him up. It was very interesting because when I debriefed him in San Francisco afterwards, I was very interested, obviously, to see what lessons we could learn. And that was one. Get a beacon that you can't be confused with. The other one was, he said, well, I was feeling fine. You know, I'd hit my leg on the rudder as I went overside, but the pain had gone and I was feeling fine. Nothing was happening. I said, you were dying, pal. You didn't have long to live. Your body was giving up. Just as well we got you when we did, because the body just quietly slumbers away and dies. But we got him back. And it was most useful because we were able to debrief him and learn a lot from it. Now, we practice consistently how to recover people from the water. And we've had five people go overside in the course of 24 years. We've always recovered them. And that's down to the team training. Sadly, on two occasions, they drowned. But we've always got them back. And I think it's down to the training. And when you talk to the crews, you say, look, how was it? Oh, we went into auto. You trained us so hard that we just didn't think about it. There was no panic. We just got on with it. And I thought, good. That's exactly how I want it. I've trained you to the point you don't start to think, you just do. And that's the best form of training.
Thank you for the call, Patty. Appreciate it. Go ahead, Karen.
Sure.
You know, I've been thinking a lot about the merchant seamen today, especially with the pandemic. My understanding is that there's many who have served maybe a year and they can't go back home because of the circumstances. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think it's been the way the seamen have been treated is disgraceful because they've carried on working. And, you know, in my country, we've got about 2 weeks' worth of fuel before we run out of gas and fuel. If those tankers don't come in, we've got a problem. Same with food. But those guys have just kept on working. Now, governments have just totally ignored their plight. You know, these guys, they can't get home. They can't get off the ships. Governments won't let them leave the ships. They have flights for them. I don't think they're heroes, but I think they're making an incredible sacrifice for the rest of us. And I don't think it's been recognized. Now, about a week ago, there was a meeting where they agreed they're going to do something about it. Well, I just hope the bloody bureaucrats do, because, quite honestly, these people have just been forgotten. And they deserve our respect for the sacrifice they've been making to keep trade running while this pandemic's raging.
No doubt about it. When I was in London in October, I took a cruise to Hampton Court down the Thames, which was a lovely little cruise going through some locks along the way. But I saw countless – first of all, I can't believe how much the residential has improved. I mean, there was just these beautiful flats everywhere. But I noticed countless little – yacht clubs and, you know, whatever it was, kayak, little, all over the place. How many of those private yacht clubs are you a member of, Sir Robin?
Well, not many on the Thames because I'm more inclined to be based where it goes to the sea. I'm an honorary member of 25 yacht clubs
Wow.
here and abroad. and I pay for one, and that's my local club, the Portsmouth Sailing Club, which is 100 years old this year, which is, I think, 80% of us live within a mile of it. And it's the cheapest beer and wine in town, so, and it's 80 crawling yards from my home, so it's extremely convenient.
That sounds great. You know, the yacht club is, now, the yacht clubs are closed now, are they not still? For us, they are.
We've opened slightly. For instance, I could, in an hour's time, I could go over and have a beer. But we're keeping distances. We're, you know, watching the distances. We're limiting the number of people. We're watching it very carefully because I think everyone's expecting a spike come the autumn when things get colder and damper. And so we're just trying to play this carefully because it looks like we've got a breakthrough from Oxford in the vaccines, judging from today's news. And we might have a vaccine by the end of the year, which would be fantastic. But, you know, until we get a vaccine, I think we've just got to be terribly careful.
It wasn't that long ago that Harry Redknapp won the FA Cup there at Pompey. Do you ever get over to Fratton Park?
I've been there once. I'm more a rugby fan than soccer. I played rugby when I was at school. Obviously, you play soccer occasionally, but I'm more of a rugby fan. But I have attended a match there. The one thing about Portsmouth, we've got a population of 200,000, and about 10% of it actively support the football team, and they actually own it. They all put money in when it got into financial trouble. So it's one of the very few clubs that's owned by its fans. And the enthusiasm here for our soccer team is enormous. You wouldn't dare ever come against it. Now, we had a very funny situation because we've got the Spinnaker Tower built for the Millennium, and the council decided they'd like a sponsor, so they got Emirates to sponsor it. Well, their colours are red. Well, now, red, we're blue here in Portsmouth. That's our colour. Red is the colour of our worst enemies, Southampton. And there was a total uproar. And the result is the Spinnaker Tower is blue.
Yes, I've actually been to St. Mary's Stadium, which replaced the Dell down there in Southampton. Listen, we could talk to Sir Robin Knox-Johnston all day. As I said, one of the great maritime heroes of the United Kingdom and one of the best solo sailors of all time. Sir Robin, thank you so much for your time, and we look forward to having you on again. Can't wait.
Well, I think we've got something planned, and it's been great talking to you, and I like the questions. We had some good ones.
Thank you so much, Robin.
Yes, and Karen, before we go, anything that you'd like to impart on our listeners?
Well, you know, I think this this thought about the merchant seamen that are out there, I would really love to see something happening with that so that, you know, countries, because we have, 168, 177 somewhere countries listening to our show, and if there are any people in positions of authority who could, you know, pay attention to what's happening on the water. That body of water is actually a lot bigger than our body of land, you know?
That's true. Karen, thanks for your time. We'll see you next week, kid.
Okay. Thanks.
All right, Rick.
Bye-bye.
Let's talk about some bodies on the other side. I'm Rick Tittle. Come on back on Sports Byline USA.